Welcome to this special audio program specifically targeted to radiation oncologists, lingering controversies and emerging therapeutic strategies for patients with locally advanced non-small cell lung cancer. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Andreas Rimner, and to begin, I asked him about the initial evaluation and staging of patients with locally advanced non-small cell lung cancer.
The workhorse is still PET CT staging. An MRI of the brain is absolutely critical in these patients to rule out metastatic disease. And invasive mediastinal staging, I think, is important to anyone for any questionable nodes or PET avid nodes. In my practice, I especially pay attention that the PET scan is up to date. So if a PET scan is older than 6 weeks, I repeat it at the time of simulation for treatment planning. That's been demonstrated to have advantages in more accurate targeting of the tumor from a radiation perspective. And you do pick up about 10% or so patients that you upstage at the time of repeat PET scan. So this is just characteristic of locally advanced disease where there's a fair number of microscopic or systemic disease that declares itself in a relatively short period of time.
Could you maybe go through a typical clinical scenario where a patient with locally advanced disease ends up having surgery?
Pretty much any patient who is young, fit, so where there are no objections from an operability perspective, are being considered for it, especially if they have single station N2 involvement with a resectable primary mass, ideally with a lobectomy. Those would be ideal candidates for the surgery approach. So patients that have somewhat limited stage 3A disease, we would shy away from a resection when a pneumonectomy might be necessary to achieve a gross total resection, or when there's multi-station N2 or even suspicion for N3 disease, of course.
Could you talk about your approach in the neoadjuvant setting for a typical patient with stage 3A lung cancer?
Yeah, just a very standard type of stage 3A patient would be someone with, let's say, a lung adenocarcinoma without a driver mutation that comes in with a right upper lobe mass, T2 mass in the right upper lobe, and a right paratracheal lymph node, maybe a questionable right hilar node. So it would be consistent with N2 disease in one single lymph node station in the right paratracheal space. So those patients we would typically see in by all the disciplines, and typically we would recommend neoadjuvant chemotherapy. Typically, if we can, we would confirm the nodal involvement by an EBUS or a bronchoscopy with a biopsy of the right paratracheal lymph node. And then if this was a lung adenocarcinoma, our general approach is a platinum pemetrexed approach with 4 cycles. We do assess the response every 2 cycles with a CT scan. And then that would be followed up by surgical resection, in this case, a right upper lobectomy and mediastinal lymph node dissection. And then if the lymph node is still positive at the time of surgery under pathology examination, we would offer that patient postoperative radiation therapy to the right paratracheal space and the right hilum where the bronchus was taken off.
Could you talk a little bit about the way you approach the radiation therapy in that situation, the technique that you utilize at Memorial, and what are some of the other radiation oncology approaches?
In postoperative radiation therapy, we typically treat to a dose of 54 gray in 30 fractions. And we target only the involved nodal levels. We don't do what is called elective nodal irradiation, meaning we don't treat the entire mediastinum. We don't treat nodal levels that are not involved or found to be uninvolved at the time of surgical dissection. We will always cover the ipsilateral hilum because that's where the transitioning lymphatics are running to the N2 nodes. And it's usually not a very big difference in terms of expanding the field to cover that space. We'll typically use a 3D or IMRT technique with image guidance daily. The 3D versus IMRT approach depends a little bit sometimes on insurance clearance, unfortunately, and there's no absolute right or wrong. Really, what the bottom line is that the lung constraints and the normal tissue constraints have to be met no matter which technique you use, and that is certainly part of the treatment planning and can be well evaluated with modern techniques.
Any comments on other techniques of radiation therapy in this situation, including proton beam?
Yeah, proton beam radiation is, of course, an exciting novel therapy. It's not to my knowledge, been prospectively evaluated specifically in the postoperative setting. We're working on a study like that. In my mind, proton therapy might be actually a really good technique for the mediastinum. Some of the challenges of proton therapy in thoracic radiation oncology have to do with respiratory motion and significant tissue density differences. And many of those issues are not as significant when we talk about targeting the mediastinum. The advantage of proton therapy is that the beam comes in from one direction and stops at a certain point, or you can make it stop. And then any tissue that is posterior or distal to that stopping point will receive no radiation. So it's an ideal technique when there is a target, a little bit of space between the target and the organ that we are trying to avoid, so that we can stop the beam right in between. So, for instance, the spinal cord we could completely avoid with postoperative radiation therapy with proton beam. Maybe more importantly, it would be really nice in some scenarios, and that depends on where the target would be located, but it would be really helpful to avoid the esophagus and the lungs more effectively with proton radiation if there is enough space in between the area that needs to be targeted and those organs.
Do you do proton beam therapy at Memorial?
So our proton radiation center is built and should be operational in June.
How do you see that fitting into your practice, if at all?
So I think it will really add another tool to our practice. It is a New York proton consortium, so it's not just Memorial. It's a consortium of several academic institutions that are working together. But we, of course, have a significant interest and portion in it. We are planning to design, and we are in the process of designing trials, because we would like to really use this as an academic opportunity to treat as many patients as possible and monitor them in a prospective fashion. So, for instance, the port question that we just discussed would be an ideal one, but we really plan to do that across all organ sites. So each organ site or disease team has a list of trials that they would like to do that they're designing for the center that should be up and running by the time the center opens.
Any other new or evolving radiation techniques that are used in the community that you want to comment on?
It's a little bit unclear what the role is of stereotactic radiation in locally advanced lung cancer. Obviously, that has revolutionized early stage lung cancer. It plays an increasing role in oligometastatic lung cancer, and that oftentimes is actually a scenario that we end up with in the locally advanced patient population. So as I said earlier, when we repeat a PET scan for restaging, it's not uncommon that one detects one, two, or three early metastases. And so generally, oligometastatic disease is defined as less than 5 metastases, and that is somewhat arbitrary. But in those scenarios, stereotactic radiation therapy does play an increasing role. It has been shown in 2 studies last year that it results in a progression-free and an overall survival benefit when we treat all sites of disease with aggressive local therapy such as surgery or stereotactic radiation. And that will be an increasing indication for that.
I see that, yeah, actually part of a paper just published in the journal Thoracic and Cardiovascular Surgery, not one that I usually read. It was actually a meta-analysis of stereotactic body radiation versus surgery for patients with lung cancer. Can you talk about what you looked at there and what you found? I guess that was for localized disease.
Yeah, that was for early stage disease. That's right. That's an ongoing question where the borderline resectable patients, where is the right line between offering surgery versus stereotactic radiation therapy? I come from the perspective that stereotactic radiation really has improved what we can offer from a radiation perspective dramatically. It's changed our local control rates from about 60% to the 90% range. And that's a gigantic jump in long-term local control. So we have now a tool that really is a fair rival to surgical resection and is really an alternative, when before it wasn't really an alternative. It was really only an option for anyone who was completely inoperable. And with more tools available, of course, come questions on where to draw the right line. I think what is clear is that both surgical resection and stereotactic radiation therapy, SBRT or SABR, both of those acronyms are being used, result in very high local control rates If there is a difference, it's in the 5 to 10% range, and that includes local control as well as progression-free survival. So there are multiple randomized studies ongoing that will really have to be the benchmark, or will really have to be the studies that we need to go by to solve this question. I don't think any meta-analysis or retrospective large analyses can really replace that. It's not level one evidence. But what we see is that surgery and SBRT are remarkably close in outcomes.
Where I've heard it mainly discussed is in patients who are elderly or too ill to have surgery. Is that the main situation where it's used?
Yeah, at this point in time, that is really the main target population. Patients who are clearly inoperable or patients where surgery is considered to be quite risky and that are considered borderline resectable. And then a few patients who prefer a non-operative approach. I'm not of the opinion that we should offer stereotactic radiation therapy as standard of care for resectable and clearly operable patients. I think that would be premature. But as I said, it's for the first time a real alternative for the patients that are at high risk for surgery.
So let's get into the issue of chemo radiation for locally advanced disease, and particularly, as you mentioned, the new development in terms of the use of consolidation checkpoint inhibitors. And maybe to get into that, we could hear about your 74-year-old man.
So that one is a pretty typical standard patient with locally advanced disease as we see them now. The patient was 74 years old, had a history of hypertension, diabetes, and coronary artery disease, had a recent CABG, and had stage 3C disease with bilateral mediastinal involvement and right supraclavicular lymphadenopathy.
He was a smoker?
Yes, he was a smoker. He did not have an actionable mutation. He had quit smoking, so he was a former smoker.
And what actually brought him to see a physician? Was he symptomatic?
Yes, he had developed a cough, he had a pneumonia that then was treated and cleared, but in the process of the workup was found to have a mass and mediastinal lymphadenopathy.
What did the initial workup of this man show?
It was a CT scan that showed a left upper lobe mass, mediastinal fullness, and then on CT scan, a right supraclavicular lymph node as well.
And did he have a chronic lung disease?
Not officially diagnosed, but after many decades of smoking, I think it's fair to assume that. He had mostly cardiac disease from his smoking.
Can you talk about his workup and biopsy? How was that done and what did it show?
So he had a core needle biopsy of the left upper lobe mass that showed a lung adenocarcinoma. There were no actionable driver mutations. He did not have metastatic disease on a PET scan that followed the CAT scan of the chest. He had no metastatic disease on an MRI of the brain. And because he had bilateral mediastinal and contralateral supraclavicular disease, he was started on concurrent chemo radiation. He was not a surgical candidate because of the extent of the disease as well as his cardiac comorbidities.
Can you talk a little bit about specifically the fields that you designed and the treatment that you gave to him?
So we, again, do not do any elective nodal radiation. We treat the disease that is there, that is PET CT guided. So what we do is we outline what we call the gross tumor volume, the GTV. We always obtain a 4D CT scan at the time of simulation to measure any respiratory movement and account for that in a so-called ITV. Then we add a margin for microscopic extension, which is on the order of 7 to 8 millimeters, which is based on radiologic and pathologic correlative studies. And then we add a 5 millimeter margin for what we call setup error, just because no patient can lie perfectly still on the table. So those are our margin expansions. We, as I said, do not treat with elective nodal radiation fields. It's been shown that the risk of failing in nodes that are not initially involved when we take this approach is less than 10%. It's on the order of 5 to 7% when a patient is PET staged, and that is generally considered an acceptable risk, but in return to avoid significantly increased side effects, mostly esophagitis and pneumonitis, by treating smaller fields. In these cases, we always use an IMRT technique. It's not really possible to meet normal tissue constraints without an IMRT technique. We do daily 2D KV imaging to verify the setup positioning. We do weekly cone beam CTs to verify any marked soft tissue changes during the treatment that may require replanning or readjustment of the treatment fields. Luckily, that does not happen too often, but once in a while, we may have to adjust it. For instance, if there was a lung collapse or a pleural effusion or things that really could change the dosimetry. But in addition to that, it also just gives us a sense on how the tumor responds to the treatment and whether things are going as planned.
Could you talk a little bit about what happened as you treated him?
So he was doing remarkably well. We were actually a little bit nervous about his recent CABG that he was just recovering from, but he really tolerated the treatment remarkably well. He had some mild esophagitis towards the end of the 6 weeks. He did not develop pneumonitis, which is usually not happening that early on anyway. The main side effect during the treatment is really fatigue, esophagitis, skin irritation. And because of the esophagitis, oftentimes dehydration or decreased oral intake, which can further weaken the patient. But he did actually remarkably well with just a little bit of supportive medications to help with his swallowing.
In his situation, I don't know whether he actually is the kind of person who, you know, asked you more detailed information, but with the conclusion of this treatment, what would you estimate his prognosis to be, his chance of developing recurrence, metastatic disease, and death? And can you talk a little bit about sort of the history of what's been going on to try to improve the outcome that preceded, you know, this big trial with the durvalumab? What had been done up until that time? But how would you have seen his prognosis at that point, assuming, you know, before we had this other new approach?
So for the last 20, 30 years, we've tried to make really inroads in locally advanced lung cancer with different radiation techniques. And I think what we've achieved the most is decreased side effects by shrinking the fields, by using more conformal radiation techniques, by avoiding organs at risk in a better way, and also defining better how much radiation organs at risk can take and how much we need to restrict them. Much time and effort has been invested in dose escalation on the radiation side. There were several institutional trials, including our institution, where we tried to escalate the dose to 70, 80, even 90 gray. And the initial results were quite promising, but were somewhat biased by smaller tumors being treated to higher doses. And that can more easily, safely be achieved than if one has a typical, you know, stage 3B or 3C patients like the patient that we just discussed, in whom it's likely not safe to go to those doses. This was followed by a large randomized phase 3 trial, RTOG-0617, which compared 60 gray versus 74 gray and showed that the higher dose arm did not result in better overall survival. In fact, it was worse survival and even more surprisingly, even worse local control. Now, there's many reasons why one can speculate why that might be. Technical reasons, quality control reasons. One of the factors that came out was cardiac radiation dose, which was correlated with survival, which is not completely clear yet what the pathophysiology behind that is. But what became clear was that just going to a higher dose on a blanket prescription basis, meaning everybody should get 74 gray no matter how large the tumor is or what it involves, is probably a little too simplistic of an approach and does not work. So 60 gray remains the standard of care in terms of the radiation dose. Similar efforts have been done on the medical oncology side with adding more chemotherapy, either before concurrent chemo radiation or after concurrent chemo radiation for consolidation or maintenance. And those also have failed. They all showed increased toxicity, but no improvement in survival.
I think that RTOG trial also looked at cetuximab, the anti-EGFR antibody. I think it was during the chemo radiation, was it not?
Yep.
And I guess in a way to try to sensitize it, or that seemed to fail also.
Yeah, there were some early phase data that suggested that cetuximab may have a role. And obviously EGFR plays a role in lung cancer. And that was really at a time where the whole mutational landscape was still being discovered and the driver mutations and the erlotinibs and TKI landscape really evolved. So I think it was an early idea. It was designed in 2006 or started in 2006. So cetuximab was added as a third and fourth arm to compare with and without cetuximab, each of the arms. And that failed as well. That did not show any significant difference. It was also not a selected patient population for EGFR overexpression or anything like that.
I don't know if this man asked you for, you know, some ideas in terms of numbers, in terms of likelihood that he was going to develop recurrence and metastatic disease. If he did, or even if he didn't, what numbers would you have given him?
I'm generally very cautious with numbers because it can be very misleading. Not that numbers are not real, but when talking to patients, I generally caution that a number is only an average number. It does not give a specific prognosis for an individual. If, let's say, someone has a 90% chance of surviving but is in the unlucky 10%, that doesn't help you that 90% of the other patients do well because you're in the unlucky 10%. And the other way around, if your chance of doing well is only 10%, but you're one of the lucky 10%, you know, that does not affect you that that 90% of people in your situation don't do well. But generally, the median survival is on the order of 2 to 3 years. That is, I think, consistent across more recent trials. And I still tell patients that the long-term chances that they will be completely without lung cancer recurrence are, if they really ask me numbers, are on the order of 30% with more modern chemoradiation. And that's really changed with the addition of adjuvant durvalumab, which you alluded to.
So let's get into that a little bit. And I was really curious about the relationship between radiation therapy and tumor immunogenicity and the old abscopal effect that people have always loved to talk about. Can you kind of go through that?
I think at this point, it's clear that radiation does play a role in harnessing the immune system. It does play a role in changing the tumor microenvironment and allowing the immune system to infiltrate the tumors. It does play a role in exposing antigens to the immune system and possibly or probably making immunotherapies more effective. We're in the process of figuring out in what way they are best combined, these therapies, and the durvalumab study was one of the first ones to really demonstrate a significant effect. The abscopal effect really was observed actually many decades ago, but really got a lot of attention when this case report came from our institution and was published in the New England Journal, where a patient who was treated with melanoma on anti-CTLA-4 therapy did not respond, developed a paraspinal lesion that required radiation treatment, and after being treated with radiation started to respond to the anti-CTLA-4 therapy that he hadn't responded to before, and not only in the lesion that was given the radiation, but even in lesions that were not treated with radiation. And so the idea is that the radiation changed something that made the tumor more recognized by the immune system, that the immune system could attack the tumor in other locations other than the irradiated lesion.
Although what's really interesting about your case is obviously they got a checkpoint inhibitor. So it wasn't, you know, when I think about the abscopal effect, I don't know if traditionally it was something where you spontaneously saw benefit outside the radiation field or in conjunction with therapy. But now you're talking about in conjunction with immunotherapy.
Right. That was really the interesting part of that case, that a patient who had stopped responding or not responded very well to immunotherapy after the radiation therapy started responding. And what my colleagues did really nicely was they had collected correlatives and they could demonstrate that the activated T cells went up, the myeloid-derived suppressor cells went down. So they really could correlate a change in some of the components of the immune cells that correlated with the response, which was fascinating.
Anything that we know in terms of the timing, you know, the optimal timing of radiation and immunotherapy in terms of when it might be most synergistic?
That's the holy grail question right now. There's a lot of studies going on in that space. We don't have a final answer yet. The most convincing data is in the adjuvant setting after concurrent chemoradiation in stage 3 disease. That's from the durvalumab study. That's the most robust and prospective and largest study of its kind. But there is a lot of studies ongoing where we are trying to combine stereotactic radiation, for instance, with immunotherapy, either with immunotherapy given for a few cycles before the radiation, sort of emulating that case report that was presented, or doing radiation first, followed by immunotherapy. All of those are unanswered questions, as well as what is the optimal radiation dose and fractionation to really maximize the immunotherapy response.
So you cited the Pacific trial that looked at durvalumab in the consolidation setting in terms of, let's say, radiation and immunotherapy synergy. And we'll get into a little bit about what in the data makes you think it's actually synergistic as opposed to, let's just say, additive. But before we even get into that, let me ask you, were you involved in the Pacific trial specifically? Did you put patients on it or any involvement there?
No, we did not have it open at our institution at the time. We had a competing study, so therefore we didn't have it open at the time.
Okay. Can you kind of talk a little bit about the initial concerns about safety in the situation of using immunotherapy after chemoradiation, specifically in the lung?
Yeah, actually, not just in that setting, but in general, there was a lot of concern on the side of pharmaceutical industry of combining radiation with checkpoint inhibitors for lung cancer. mostly because of the rare but severe pneumonitis that had been observed with checkpoint inhibitors alone, and that made many companies very gun-shy to try and combine it with radiation. Now, I think some of that has to do with just a lack of knowledge on how radiation works and what radiation pneumonitis looks like and how we can control the dose and how we can predict the risk of pneumonitis, which would allow for some control when combining two new modalities in trying to minimize the risk and avoiding safety issues with a new combination, which obviously industry is concerned about. But what so far has come out is that there's no clear increased risk in terms of the risk of pneumonitis when combining radiation and immunotherapy. We and others have looked at this retrospectively, just in patients that have been treated on various immune checkpoint inhibitor protocols and needed palliative radiation to the chest as part of their treatment. And we did not see an increase in risk of pneumonitis or other toxicities, intrathoracic toxicities, when we looked at these given at the same time or further apart in a sequential fashion. Similarly, there was a paper in Lancet Oncology published by my colleague, Dr. Shavardian, who looked at one of the KEYNOTE studies and found that when radiation was given at a variable time point before pembrolizumab, there was no increase in toxicity and maybe an improvement in progression-free survival, which may be a synergy, but may also just be an effect of radiation being effective in its own right. And then lastly, on the PACIFIC trial, there was no clear signal that the durvalumab arm had a higher risk of severe pneumonitis compared to the placebo arm. Both were about 3% grade 3 and higher pneumonitis. That was the rate in both arms. In the lower grades, there was a slight numerical increase in the durvalumab arm, but it did not reach statistical significance.
In these initial looks at patients who'd had radiation and checkpoint inhibitors, in addition to the fact that it seemed like it was safe, particularly as it relates to the lung, was there any evidence, even cases, that looked like there might be some synergy? Stories like your patient who didn't respond and then responded, if was anything like that picked up?
Not in our retrospective series, but it's also really hard to reconstruct that in a retrospective fashion. By now, there are multiple case reports in the literature. I do believe that there is such a thing as an abscopal effect. I don't think it happens at the frequency that it's hyped as, given these very exciting case reports. We don't understand yet what triggers an abscopal effect in some patients and why it does not happen in others. Those are all questions that we would love to have an answer to, but have not fully understood yet.
So we've been talking about the specific trial. Can you kind of talk about specifically the patients that were focused on, where the trial was done, and what they actually saw?
So these were all unresectable stage 3 patients treated with concurrent chemo radiation. They accrued like a whirlwind in within a year globally, to a large degree in Asia. And it was a placebo-controlled randomized trial. It was a one-to-one randomization, and half of the patient received adjuvant durvalumab after completion of concurrent chemo radiation, and the other half received placebo. And what they found was a 20% progression-free survival improvement from about 35 to 55% at 1 year. And last year, it was also reported that this translated into a 10% overall survival benefit. And that's really the biggest jump in survival outcomes that we have seen in stage 3 lung cancer over several decades. And that's why there was a lot of excitement. It's been incorporated in the NCCN guidelines and really changed practice or standard practice for this patient population.
Can you talk a little bit more? You've been referring to this issue of the tolerability, particularly as it relates to the potential for pneumonitis. Globally, what was seen in general in terms of how the patients tolerated durvalumab? This is for a year. It's really adjuvant treatment. You don't have a specific disease you're treating. You've already treated with chemo radiation therapy. What was seen in general with tolerability? What you yourself have observed in your own practice in terms of tolerability?
Generally, it's been reasonable in terms of tolerability, although in the PACIFIC trial, there was a range during which you could start durvalumab from right at the end of chemo radiation to up to 6 weeks. They actually initially had only a 2-week window and then expanded it to 6 weeks to make it more practical and feasible. there was no clear difference in terms of duration of adjuvant durvalumab given or timing of starting durvalumab with the risk of pneumonitis. They did observe a little bit of a higher risk in Asian patients for reasons that are not quite clear. And those are just hypothesis generating observations that will have to be further looked into. There was no clear correlation with radiation dose and risk of pneumonitis, but there was a relatively tight radiation range that was used anyway, so maybe there was just not enough spread of the dose to really get a statistical difference there.
Do these patients typically have imaging after the chemo radiation and before they started durvalumab? And when you do image a patient at that point, what do you see?
So that's a very controversial question. The PACIFIC trial actually enrolled patients after completion of concurrent chemo radiation and required only that patients did not progress at the time. In some ways, that possibly biased the study a little bit towards excluding the worst players, the ones that progress right after or even during chemo radiation. But the results are very similar to other trials, so I think they still hold up. The problem with that is that there was no quality control on the radiation dose, no quality control or very minimal data collected on the chemotherapy. And so it's not clear how these factor in. In a way, the study was still quite convincing just because it was such a convincing result, but it was not by design, but in a way a little bit lucky that they had such a great result. In terms of how do we image these patients, that's a somewhat unsolved question. We have a consensus within our disease management team that we image a patient within, 2 to 4 weeks from the end of radiation with a CT scan. And if there's no clear, obvious disease progression, we offer them durvalumab if they're candidates for durvalumab. But it's definitely changed the way we follow these patients because traditionally we would only get imaging 3 months after concurrent chemo radiation because in the beginning there's a lot of inflammation and the tumor has certainly not responded fully to the treatment yet. It continues to respond over many months. So it's definitely changed that approach.
What do you see in the lung fields when you look at them after completion of radiation therapy?
Not too much. Some acute inflammation or inflammatory signs can be seen, but the dense fibrosis really develops a little bit later after radiation, in the 2 to 6 month range after the end of radiation, and that has not fully developed by the time we image them between concurrent chemo radiation and durvalumab.
So maybe we can hear a little bit more about what happened to your patient, because this 74-year-old man actually did receive durvalumab. So what happened there?
So the patient had a good response to concurrent chemo radiation, did not progress. There was a partial response that's actually pretty good to be seen that soon after chemo radiation, and therefore was offered consolidation durvalumab. After 5 months on durvalumab, he did develop some shortness of breath that was unclear whether that was radiation-related or durvalumab-related and needed a course of prednisone. But with that, he cleared it. It never got out of control. It was actually quite manageable, and he's currently NED and being followed observantly.
What was seen on imaging when he developed these shortness of breath?
Some fibrosis near the radiation field, nothing uncommon. I don't decide on whether a patient has radiation pneumonitis based on imaging only. It really remains a clinical diagnosis. Patients can have a lot of radiographic changes on their scan and no symptoms. And patients can have very severe symptoms and very minimal radiographic changes. So it's really not a good marker by itself to go by whether something is radiation pneumonitis or not.
So can you describe a scenario that, from your point of view, let's say patients on durvalumab, where you'd be pretty sure it's radiation, pneumonitis, and then a scenario where you'd be pretty sure it's related to durvalumab, and what's the difference in how you manage them?
We're never really pretty sure. That's the challenge with this, because there's no diagnostic test to distinguish durvalumab-induced pneumonitis from radiation-induced pneumonitis. We have clues. I think one of them is timing. If it is in the time frame that we think radiation pneumonitis could occur, somewhere between 2 and 6 months after the end of radiation, that would be a typical time course for radiation pneumonitis. In order to answer that question, I do pay attention a little bit to the radiographic changes that we see on imaging. If it is in the radiation field, that points a little bit more towards being radiation related. If there were no changes at all, or if there was a very diffuse picture, I would be more concerned about an infection or durvalumab related pneumonitis. If there was bilateral inflammatory changes clearly outside of the radiation field, that would make us think that it's more durvalumab related. But there's no real way to answer it. Essentially, the only saving grace is that we treat them both pretty much the same. We manage them pretty much the same with prednisone, tapered slowly over 8 to 10 weeks. At least that's the radiation pneumonitis regimen. Sometimes for durvalumab, our colleagues in medical oncology taper a little bit faster, but it's really in radiation oncology tapered based on the patient's symptoms and not too quickly in order to avoid rebound symptoms.
Do we know that corticosteroids are helpful in recovery from radiation pneumonitis?
The symptomatic relief is quite quick, yes. So typically we see symptomatic relief of shortness of breath and cough within 3 to 5 days after initiating prednisone. We typically start at 40 milligrams daily, and then we taper it, as I said, based on symptoms and make sure that symptoms don't rebound. There is a question on how long-lasting these effects are and what the long-term damage to the lungs is in patients that have had pneumonitis. We've looked at our own data and found that about half of the patients that have had radiation pneumonitis have subsequent recurring pulmonary complications or exacerbations over the following 12 months. Because of that, we have a randomized trial open combining nintedanib with prednisone in order to try and avoid or minimize the long-term effects of a patient having experienced radiation pneumonitis, essentially trying to prevent the inflammatory phase transitioning into the fibrotic phase that then has long-term implications on pulmonary functions. It's a drug that has been approved for IPF, idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis, and has been very promising in that space.
What is the drug?
Nintedanib. It's a TKI.
Nintedanib. I remember, yeah, it's a VEGF TKI?
Yep. It's actually a multi-tyrosine kinase inhibitor. It inhibits the VEGF axis, the FGF axis, PDGF axis, so multiple axes. It's not a very specific TKI. It's not been too successful as an oncology drug, but it's been actually really successful as a pulmonary drug.
Really?
And it's actually FDA approved for IPF.
Wow.
Yeah.
You use it in patients who are having radiation pneumonitis?
Correct. So we have a prospective trial ongoing for patients who have developed radiation pneumonitis.
Huh.
And it's a randomized study comparing nintedanib and prednisone versus prednisone alone, which is the standard of care.
Wow, that is really fascinating. Did they get any TKI side effects? Is it that kind of dosing?
They can. It's at 150 milligrams BID.
Wow, amazing. Huh.
And they can have some diarrhea, they can get some fatigue, some nausea. I have not seen any severe inflammatory reactions of internal organs, which have been described in these patients. Luckily, we have not observed that yet.
That's interesting. I know your colleague, Matt Hellman, the medical oncologist, I remember he wrote a paper about pneumonitis related to the checkpoint inhibitors in people with lung cancer.
Right.
And which is, you know, really tricky in general, not just in terms of locally advanced and durvalumab. Has nintedanib been used for checkpoint inhibitor pneumonitis?
Not to my knowledge.
Is there any reason to think it would work?
There's no reason to think it wouldn't work.
Do they know why it works in, you know, IPF and radiation pneumonitis?
Well, we don't know yet that it will work in radiation pneumonitis. That's why we do the study.
Okay.
But in IPF, it's been demonstrated, and there was a New England Journal article about that in 2012.
Got it. Okay.
I think it's more of a question in the stage 4 setting for checkpoint inhibitor-induced pneumonitis, how to combine it with other drugs. That's actually a question that is being examined in a few other trials. But as of now, it's only clear that in a limited number of drugs, it's safe to combine it. But for many drugs, we don't know yet whether it's safe to combine it.
So given the fact that in a patient like your patient who has multiple other comorbidities, it may be difficult to really figure out why somebody's having shortness of breath. But globally, considering everything, how often do you have to use corticosteroids following chemo radiation? Let's just put the durvalumab aside. Just in general, baseline, how often do you use it?
The risk of grade 2 or higher pneumonitis after standard concurrent chemo radiation is 15% in our hands. And in most institutions, it's somewhere between 15 and 20% in that range.
And is it higher when you give durvalumab?
Not according to the study. It was numerically higher at grade 2, not even numerically higher at grade 3 and higher. That was 3% for both arms. Grade 2 and higher was numerically a little bit higher in the durvalumab arm. But I don't think we have treated enough patients yet to have our own experience. We just submitted an abstract on our early experience with new durvalumab approach. And in that, we did not see any clear increase in pneumonitis. The numbers are still too small.
So you mentioned that maybe globally a patient like this maybe would have a 70% chance, you know, developing metastatic disease and, you know, dying of their lung cancer. In your own mind, do you see durvalumab? And of course, we don't know for sure yet, but do you see durvalumab as improving the cure rate?
So when you look at the survival curves, there is a tail, which is what makes us all very excited. We haven't seen a tail like that for a long time. Obviously, we need longer follow-up, longer-term follow-up. The published survival data are all within the 1 to 2 year range. We don't have 5 year data yet. So we're all very hopeful that it will translate into a real cure or an increase in cure in these patients. The tail is at least suggesting that, but I think it's a little premature to say that.
Any data to suggest that by shortening the course of durvalumab, so instead of giving a year, you end up giving 8 months or 4 months, any suggestion that it impairs the outcome in terms of efficacy?
No, we don't know what the right answer is there. Actually, when you look at the PACIFIC trial, most patients did not receive all 12 months of durvalumab. It's either because they had side effects or because of logistical issues or didn't want to continue. And that is actually a debate for designing upcoming trials, what the right duration is. And the debate goes in both directions. Some argue for shorter courses because most patients received actually a shorter course and that's what the data is based on. Some argue that if it works well, why not continue beyond 1 year if a patient tolerates it well and has good disease control? We don't know the answer to that at this point. We just know that this study was done with 1 year of adjuvant or up to 1 year of adjuvant durvalumab, and that's what we have at this point. I think there will be multiple studies coming down the road with variable time frames of adjuvant immune checkpoint inhibition, and hopefully that will give us an answer. We are designing some ourselves.
So thinking about what you're saying, you know, we know that, let's say, 15% of these people are going to have steroid requiring pneumonitis-related radiation therapy, and yet you may not know whether it's that or the durvalumab. So I assume these people are going to have the durvalumab held. Would you ever restart it?
So I leave that decision to my medical oncology colleagues. I think it depends on the severity. Generally, if someone has really had a severe bout of pneumonitis, we'll be cautious in just restarting it if we really think it was drug-related. We have one patient who developed pneumonitis after just a single dose of atezolizumab, and the patient really wanted to go back on it, but we were quite cautious about doing that. So we don't know what the right answer is. I think it can be tried cautiously, but there is certainly a risk.
So I'm not aware there's another phase 3 trial, at least reported, looking at consolidation with a checkpoint inhibitor. But can you talk about what other research has been done looking at checkpoint inhibition in the post-chemo radiation situation?
In the post-chemo radiation situation, that is the one study that is published. What people are doing now is trying to move up durvalumab or other checkpoint inhibition into the concurrent setting. So trying to start it with the initiation of chemo radiation or replacing chemotherapy with immune checkpoint inhibition. We have a study that will open soon on radiation therapy and durvalumab in lieu of chemotherapy. And this is for the poor KPS patients who are not even candidates for concurrent chemo radiation, because actually concurrent chemo radiation is only for the fittest of the unresectable patients. But there's a large patient population that has to be treated with either radiation alone or sequential chemo radiation because it would be too aggressive and too risky to treat them with concurrent chemo radiation even before the advent of durvalumab. And so those patients have an even worse prognosis with an even higher rate of distant metastases and disease progression. And these patients are really in need of an improved outcome. So we are starting a trial where we do durvalumab concurrently with radiation without chemotherapy, getting rid of chemotherapy in that patient population. And we're hopeful to see a progression-free survival benefit there.
There have been studies, I know they're not randomized that I know about, but there have been, I think, phase 2 studies looking at other checkpoint inhibitors in patients getting pembrolizumab, for example. What do we know about other checkpoint inhibitors?
No. On the one hand, we think of them all having a similar mechanism of action. On the other hand, there are definitely differences observed in response, also in the neoadjuvant setting, as well as in the tolerability. So these are open questions. We don't know yet how they stack up against each other.
What about the use of neoadjuvant checkpoint inhibitors prior to radiation therapy? There's been some really exciting work out of your institution, Jamie Chad et al., looking. I was really stunned. I mean, they gave these people I think they were resectable patients that gave two doses of a checkpoint inhibitor. Were you involved with that?
Not directly, obviously. That's a medical oncology study, but I work very closely with Jamie Chaffin on multiple other projects.
Can you kind of talk about, you know, from your point of view, what they saw there and what you thought about it?
They definitely saw a remarkable number of complete or near complete responses at pathologic examination, more than we typically anticipate with chemotherapy. However, the numbers are small, and the endpoint of these studies were safety first, not an efficacy endpoint. So while we are very excited about these numbers and these indications, we have to be cautious and will need to be followed up with larger scale studies. But still, I think it's very intriguing to see the kind of responses that we see in the neoadjuvant setting with, as you said, just very few doses of immune checkpoint inhibition, which then again relates to the question, how many doses do you need to give even in the adjuvant setting to get an immune response? The neoadjuvant studies suggest that you get a response quite early and quite robustly. From a radiation perspective, there was no concurrent radiation in the preoperative setting. And if anything, it would decrease the number of patients needing postoperative radiation therapy if they really clear their mediastinum completely. Or at least that is an open question that needs to be addressed. We don't know how to integrate PORT in that scenario.
Any other research initiatives going on with locally advanced lung cancer that involve checkpoint inhibitors or anything else that you're excited about?
So there's other studies looking at different doses and fractionations of radiation with immune checkpoint inhibition. Within the NRG oncology group, there is a hypofractionated design with 4 gray times 15 fractions, comparing that to the standard 2 gray times 30 fractions. Those are some questions that are being explored. There are several trials in the early stage setting following SBRT for stage 1 or 2 lung cancer where adjuvant immune checkpoint inhibition is being added in order to prevent disease progression, because even in those patients, there is about a 25% to 30% risk of disease progression, even in patients who present with a small 1 centimeter or 1.5 centimeter lung nodule without nodal involvement. And even in that patient population, we need to do better.
I'm sure you see a lot of patients who've been seen by other doctors, who've been treated by other radiation oncologists. Any, I'm not going to say mistakes, but things that you see people doing that, you know, maybe you don't do or you think could be done better?
I still see a fair amount of older technique being used.
Really?
3D conformal radiation with cone downs when I see patients coming from elsewhere. I still see some people pushing the radiation dose beyond 60 gray. Some people using smaller doses per fraction and dragging it out longer, which also I think is not advisable. I think it's quite clear that the standard should be 2 gray times 30, at least in the United States. So those are some of the things that I still observe. Stereotactic radiation still has not been rolled out in all places for early stage lung cancer. It's still being underutilized in the oligometastatic setting. Those are two other areas where we can do better. I think that the last point is maybe just a difference in how we practice. We just, as I said earlier, use relatively little preoperative chemo radiation, and to a degree that's historical. There's no data to say that you can absolutely not do that or that's absolutely a worse approach. It's just not been our approach.
You've mentioned a couple of times now treating oligomets. What are some of the sites that you treat and some of the sites that you're most successful with?
In our department, we actually have subspecialized services for that.
Wow.
We have a service for metastatic disease. We have a spine service for spine SBRT led by Dr. Yamada. We have a CNS team that treats all the brain SRS. So we really split it up amongst ourselves. I obviously do the lung SBRT also for oligometastatic disease from other primary histologies that has spread to the lung. So I treat some of these, but not all of these patients.
Any comments on treating adrenal mets? How often do you do it? What kind of success do you have with it?
We do, and I have treated them myself as well. Sometimes our GI colleagues treat some of those. They can be treated with image-guided or stereotactic techniques. We usually treat them in 3 to 5 treatments. I think it's important in that area to pay attention to the bowel very closely, because that is probably the one organ that can see some severe toxicity if one is not careful. So it's important to delineate the bowel very carefully and make sure that that stays within clear and strict constraints to avoid perforations or bleeding or severe toxicities. But it can be very successfully used and save the patient from having to undergo an adrenalectomy.
So let's finish out hearing about maybe a couple more of your cases. How about this 72-year-old lady? This is an interesting case.
That was another patient with unresectable stage 3B adenocarcinoma. Her disease was quite extensive, with a T4N3M0 tumor encasing the left pulmonary artery. It was KRAS mutant, and there was a 20% PD-L1 expression. She was treated with standard concurrent chemoradiation with carboplatin and pemetrexed and 60 gray standard dose in 30 fractions.
Can I just ask, did the encasement of the pulmonary artery in any way affect the way you approached the case?
Not from a radiation perspective, but if she didn't have multiple nodal stations involved, that would have been the make or break between what might have considered resectable disease. But that is a decision that we always do in conjunction with the surgeon. We don't decide for the surgeon what is resectable, just like they don't decide for us what can be radiated or not.
So what happened there?
She completed chemo radiation. She did well. And then a few weeks after recovery from the chemo radiation, she started on durvalumab. She was one of the unfortunate women who developed an infection, pretty severe pneumonia with sepsis, and even an empyema that had to be drained. But she recovered from that, and she's currently NED and just followed being monitored observantly.
When did she develop this infection?
About 4 months after chemo radiation.
So she was on the durvalumab at that point?
She had gotten 4 doses, yes. So 8 weeks.
And what was your interpretation of what happened? Do you think it was a complication of durvalumab or had nothing to do with it?
It's hard to say. These things can happen even with chemo radiation. They don't happen frequently, but I think it points to the need to have a multidisciplinary team who knows how to also address complications. Even with standard chemo radiation, there's a 2 to 3% mortality risk, actually, in most studies. This is not an easy treatment. It's not an easy clinical scenario to deal with. Lung cancer is an aggressive disease that can have a lot of ramifications, and patients are sick. So it's hard to say whether it was the durvalumab itself or it would have happened even without the durvalumab.
What do you see? I mean, as you mentioned, chemo radiation is difficult to go through. So these people are maybe, you know, not in the same condition they are when they start. At the point that they're starting durvalumab, what have you observed in terms of quality of life impact on top of the durvalumab? Do you think it adds fatigue or any quality of life issues at all?
Yeah, it does. I think overall, generally speaking, the immune checkpoint inhibitors have been tolerated quite well. But when patients develop side effects on them, they can be quite severe. So it's either you do really well and you have very little side effects, or when you have them, it can be quite severe. In terms of quality of life, the other factor that really affects patients is having to come in every 2 weeks. So there's different regimens that are being explored now every 4 weeks. That's another open question. How frequently do you have to deliver it? But coming in every 2 weeks for an indefinite amount of time or a year's time is a long time. So that's definitely a quality of life factor for patients.
How many patients do you think you've had who received durvalumab in post-consolidation?
About 40 at our institutions over the last year since it became standard.
Really? Wow. And, you know, when a patient asks you, based on your own experience and what you've read from the data, what is the likelihood that somebody's just going to cruise through the year without any problems?
I would say about 60, 70% of patients do well without major issues. And another 30%, you know, have some issues that we can address and get them through, maybe another 5 or 10% with more severe side effects that require hospitalization or so.
I was talking to a doc who's an oncology fellow. She's a chief fellow at North Carolina. I was just thinking about the fact that I don't know if people realize who haven't been in the field for a long time how frustrating it was with locally advanced lung cancer. I mean, so many things were tried and really nothing, zero, worked at all until this, really. I mean, that was the way I was seeing it.
Yeah, we have not made really any progress since 2 or 3 decades at least. I mean, there's an old study that looked at radiation at 40 rads back then, 40, 50, and 60 rads, and that showed a dose response. So 60 rads became the standard, and we're still at 60 gray. So yeah, from just a pure dosing perspective, not much has happened other than improvement in technique and trying to minimize side effects. But the durvalumab, in terms of disease control and survival, we haven't moved the needle very much until this trial.
So let's finish out hearing about your 55-year-old lady here. One of the things about her that I think is interesting that we haven't talked about yet is the issue of patients with targetable mutations. You mentioned your other two patients didn't, but this patient looks like they had an EGFR tumor mutation. So what happened with her?
Right. So she was treated with neoadjuvant atezolizumab on a protocol. Then she underwent surgery. per protocol, she had N2 involvement and received adjuvant chemotherapy because of that.
Could I just ask, just out of curiosity, how did she do in the atezolizumab neoadjuvantly? Did she respond?
She did well, although she was one of the few that didn't respond.
Did not respond.
So even though, as we said earlier, many patients responded really well, she was one of the people who did not have a good response and therefore was treated with standard chemotherapy and radiation therapy in the adjuvant setting in a sequential fashion. And then the question was, because she had an EGFR mutation, should she go on an adjuvant TKI or not? And that's a controversial question, better posed to our medical oncology colleagues. But as you know, there were trials investigating adjuvant TKI, and they had a progression-free survival benefit, but that did not translate into an overall survival benefit. And so believers do offer it, and non-believers don't offer it.
Your pulmonary oncologist actually, I think, the most proactive, I think, about using adjuvant TKIs in this situation. Most people don't do it outside a trial setting, but it seems like it's not uncommon for your group too.
No, we believe that if you have a genetic driver and you have a drug that works for that driver mutation, that there's a benefit to that. Our institution was one of the first to really move that field forward. So we're believers.
Yeah, well, you know, it's so controversial. It comes up all over oncology. You never know what to do. We just had the SOLO-1 trial looking at a PARP inhibitor of ovarian cancer. Everybody knew it was going to be positive, but nobody did it until they saw the data. But your group's maybe a little bit more proactive. Can you talk a little bit about how you designed her ports and the treatment you gave her in the adjuvant setting after she had surgery?
That was a very standard port field. The right level 4 lymph node was involved, as well as the subcoronal node and several right hilar nodes. So we covered the right level 4, the subcoronal space, and the right hilum with the radiation field.
So this also brings up the issue of what do you do with people with targetable mutations who aren't resectable? And there are a lot of things that have been discussed. One thing maybe we ought to comment on is there were patients with targetable mutations in the PACIFIC trial. You know, it looked like they benefited as well. I'm kind of curious, was that your take? And are you giving durvalumab to, for example, this patient had had chemo radiation, was not resectable?
So in those patients, we still offer it, although sometimes our medical oncology colleagues will weigh the risks and balances between putting them on a durvalumab versus a TKI in the adjuvant setting. It's an unclean science at this point, right? But they will look at the PD-L1 expression. They'll look at, you know, what comorbidities they have. Do they have contraindications for a TKI or for an immunotherapy? And then they will decide based on those factors.
That's really interesting because, you know, in the rest of the country, they're kind of deciding about their durvalumab or not because, like, TKIs are off the table because most people aren't doing it. But your people kind of choose that they ever do both. Would they give a TKI and during the durvalumab?
I have not observed them do that, no.
Yeah, that seems like it might be a little bit out of bounds there. Anything that we haven't talked about today that you want to comment on? Any, you know, other thing that you've talked about with radiation oncologists as it relates to lung cancer that we haven't talked about?
Something that happens in the radiation oncology community is the MR linear accelerator. So that's maybe a new tool that is becoming a little bit more available. MR-guided therapy that is particularly helpful in areas that have soft tissue, targets within soft tissues where CT has limitations in terms of imaging capabilities and really identifying the target. So we have an MR simulator. We are getting an MR linear accelerator within this year. And we are planning to do trials on that. In the thorax, it's particularly challenging because MR is very sensitive to motion degradation of the images. But at the same time, if we can get it to work, which is what we're working towards, it would allow monitoring of the tumor location in real time during the treatment because you could actually see the tumor move as the patient breathes on the table. And that would provide an unprecedented level of precision if we can make that work. And in the mediastinal and perihilar areas, it would likely be most beneficial as well, because those are the areas that are not well seen on, let's say, a cone beam CT, which can visualize a nodule in the peripheral lung quite well, but the mediastinum or the esophagus or the mediastinal structures are much harder to see on cone beam CTs.